Unbelievably, the sun is shining in the West Country, and this is episode #022 of the Back to Front Show. Hello, Kieran.
Hello. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. Sun shining in Wales today?
It certainly is, yep.
A pleasant change.
Are out. There's a children's birthday party happening next door, so if you hear any screaming, that's what that is.
Yes, the country idyll in beautiful Wales. Mm-hmm. Somerset? I can never remember. Do you live in Somerset?
Yeah, of course I do.
Yeah.
Deepest, darkest.
Somerset.
Yep.
Yeah, episode 22. Had we kept to our schedule, we'd be up to about 40 now.
But we're not going to linger on that.
We're not going to linger on that. Like, we won't linger on the fact that we're not nominated for Podcast of the Year, but...
Yeah, we're moving on.
I did get an email the other day from Mr. Craig Lockwood, Craig in Wales, on the Twitter.
Oh, yeah.
Who, apparently we have won an award.
Have we?
Yeah, he's given us an award for most underrated podcast of the year.
That's kind of him. Thank you, Craig.
It is. It's also very kind of him because he's actually sponsoring this week's show.
Hey!
Hey, do you see what I did there?
Nice.
He's going to appreciate that, isn't he? Yes, the web is Craig's new event.
Mm-hmm.
I think it should be prefixed with the word mega,
yeah.
As I used to back in the day, something mega to denote bigness. Because I think he's gone large this time.
He has.
He's gone.
He's not messing about, is he?
He's really not messing about. It looks an amazing couple of days.
Amazing.
Amazing. No, but it is. The 30th and 31st of October 2014.
Celebrating 25 years of the World Wide Web.
Of the WWW. 16 of the web's greatest innovators, storytellers and educators will be descending on Cardiff to tell their stories.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you've got the creator of the original Apple One, Mr. Wozniak.
Yeah.
I read his biography once. Quite an interesting guy.
Nice.
Do you know he did music festivals and lost a load of money?
No, I didn't.
And almost died in a plane crash, did he?
Did education stuff, didn't he, as well?
Did a lot of education stuff. You got the one and only Mr. Gary Vaynerchuk.
The powerhouse.
Yeah. He packs more words into a minute than most people.
He does. You're getting value for money there.
You're getting very, very good value for money there. Mm-hmm. We've got Mr. Brad Frost.
Genius.
I hope he doesn't sleep in the space helmet.
I doubt it. The I show his video to my students, actually, the no bullshit video.
What?
The death of all... It's fine because I'm quoting something.
Oh, is that allowed?
Yeah, of course it's allowed.
Is that subparagraph six, section C?
Yeah, exactly, of our contract.
Okay. We've got Mr. Ethan Marcotte, Mr. Responsive Web Design.
Indeed.
Our friend and yours, Mr. Mike Coos as well.
Mr. Coos is speaking. What's his Web is the New Black?
Web is the New Black. I actually did ping Mike about this because I said, have you seen the new Web is site? And he said, yeah. I said, you've gone off message with the avatar there. Have you seen the avatar he's got on Twitter? It's kind of...
There's some very stylized avatars.
Yes, he does look a bit good in that. But this one's gone off message. It's got some kind of hipster sort of checked...
Brick wall.
Pattern. Do you reckon that's photoshopped in? That might be photoshopped in.
I doubt it.
No, Craig wouldn't do that. Who else? Ah, Chris Murphy.
Oh, yes.
And who else? We've got Jim Douglas, Andy Davis, Mr. Performance. I've learned a lot from Andy. He's got a great little book on five simple steps, actually. One of the e-books.
Has he?
Mm.
Nice.
Robin Christofferson and many others. I think there's a few to be announced as well.
Really?
So where is it going to be? Motorpoint Arena in Cardiff.
Which is huge.
Huge. Live music and entertainment venue.
Lovely. So what are we talking in terms of heads?
I don't know. I think it can hold about 3,000 people.
Good Lord.
So last time he did the world's biggest stage. I'm assuming that this has a pretty big stage as well, though.
Yeah, I didn't think we clarified that was the physical size of the stage, whereas this probably is going to contain more people.
Yeah, Craig, I know you're going to be listening. So if you could clarify that point for our four listeners, that would be most appreciated. But yes, it's going to be a really interesting day. I think there's going to be a celebration of the web, but also a lot of stories and a lot of takeaways from the coalface as well. I'm going to be there. You going to be there?
Yeah, I will.
Really?
Yeah.
You're going to leave Wales?
I'm going to break with tradition.
I was going to say.
Though it is Halloween. But,
ooh.
Yeah.
So that surely means you're going to be at some kind of slasher fest or something at some local cinema.
There are events happening.
Really?
Yeah, so I might have to split my time.
No. You could maybe come in costume.
Maybe I could, yeah.
I'd pay to see that, actually.
dressed as Michael Myers.
Who? Isn't he a comedian?
No, that's Mike Myers. Yeah. Anyway, moving on from our...
Oh, I was thinking Michael McIntyre. Sorry. He's got his own chat show. Did you see that?
I haven't seen that.
No.
It has been said that you and Michael McIntyre never been seen in a room together.
Yeah, this is true.
Mm.
I don't do the floppy fringe thing. No, absolutely not. No. No, definitely not. But yeah, so the web is on 30th and 31st of October down in the beautiful Cardiff.
Which is genuinely very exciting, actually.
I'm really excited.
People
I mean,
are coming to that and the scale of the thing.
Incredible. Scale's incredible. I mean, just the people he's enticed over. Obviously, been privileged enough to see the powerhouse Vaynerchuk before, but never, you know, been in the room with Woz. Wow, that's going to be pretty special.
Yeah.
And Mike, of course.
And tickets are on sale now.
Now, yeah, you can get those.
Get them now.
Let's have a look. I'm just scrolling down.
This got 200 premium tickets available.
Yeah, that's an interesting one, isn't it? What do you get for that?
You get, let me see, you get full entry to all the talks, of course. You get our access to the after-show party. You get premium location seating.
Oh, it's like the cinema. It's like the cinema. Yeah, I like
it. See, you might get a sofa. I don't know. I'm not promising.
What do they call them? Love seats.
Yeah, I love seat. You get access to on-site Founders Hub Lounge.
Ooh.
You get to chill out in the lounge. And you get access after the show to meet and greet with the speakers.
Like it.
So you get to mingle with the Vaynerchuk and the Woz.
Well, that'd be pretty cool, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
So we've got standard tickets, £290 plus VAT, premium £340, and students £50. That is ridiculous.
That is silly cheap.
I know that's probably like 200 pints of cider or something, but, you know, if you could go without those.
It's probably about 50 pints of cider. Is it? The union.
Yeah, it's probably true, isn't it? Black currants and extra 10p. Yeah. It's all good. But yeah, check that out. The web is...
exciting.
Exciting. And yeah, we'll read out the URL at the end of the show and pop it in the show notes. But yeah, hopefully some of you can come along. Fun to hang out and... yeah, listen to the Woz.
Indeed.
You should check out his book, I Woz.
Is that what it's called?
It's called I Woz, yeah.
Nice.
It's very cool. Very interesting. Mostly the fun stuff's around, not the Apple stuff, about him trying to set up music festivals and things. But yeah, all very good. But anyway, on with the show.
Indeed.
Episode 22.
Mm-hmm.
Right, I've got a link.
Have you?
Yeah. It's a blatant that's good. Plug, to be honest.
Surely not, Keir.
Yeah, I know.
I've never heard you do a blatant plug on this show.
Well, for your projects.
No, actually, this is a first.
It is a first. Well, if you can't talk about your own stuff on your own podcast, when can you talk about it?
That is true. That is fair, yeah.
Indie Direct. This is by a young chap from Wales called Mr. Kieran Masterton.
Mm-hmm.
A one-day event dedicated to direct distribution in the film industry.
Yes, that's right.
Coming soon to a venue near you if you're in London.
That's right. Autumn
2014. Now, of course, if I manage to get this podcast out really quickly, you're going to have to get a hurry up with the website, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm actually going to have to deploy the thing.
You have to deploy the thing. So there's nothing like shipping with a P and forcing someone into it to get the stuff out there. But yeah, tell us a bit about this because it's actually really interesting. I mean, we've talked quite a bit about the cross-section of film and technology before on the show. But this really is a kind of a day to bring that conversation to the real world, IRL. And you've got plans to bring some of the key players together to discuss how this is going to happen or how it's happening and where it's going.
Yeah, that's right. I think I'm trying to focus mainly on filmmakers who've done this and have a story to tell around this, you know, taking their stuff direct to their fans with all the platforms I work with, really. Mm. So it's really a way for other filmmakers to be educated by the filmmakers who've done this already and to learn how to go direct. And also, I think a big focus upon not being, I think there's sort of inner, somewhere an article recently about the inner shame at the heart of indie film, which is that they don't want to go direct. They still want to get this wonderful deal from a studio and have their film bought at a film festival. But the people who are actually doing this and going direct are making a living and sustaining and stuff. And so it's nothing to be ashamed of. I think that's one of the key things.
So you'll be bringing people, principally filmmakers to talk, people who've actually embraced these platforms, or people from the platforms themselves, or doing
that's the idea.
Mainly
filmmakers who have used these platforms and have, real hard evidence and data to share about how they've done that and how they got on and what the real returns were, that kind of thing.
Yeah, interesting. Do you feel that? Obviously you're knee deep in this area, but do you feel that it's kind of it's kind of come to a head that some particular platform's going to win out? Is that going to be one of the themes, maybe?
Possibly. I think that we're definitely at a point where there's acceleration happening in terms of the number of platforms aiming at indie content creators, for want of a better word. And there's obviously some very big players in that market, like Vimeo and stuff like that. But I think that mainly what's happening is a lot of confusion amongst filmmakers, and also a lack of focus upon this stuff. Even though there's a lot of people trying to help filmmakers do this kind of thing, there's a lack of focus from the filmmakers on taking this route, and they're still very much focused on the festival circuit and getting their film bought.
Right.
And so what I really want to show is that there are people doing this and it does work, and that retaining your rights and all that stuff is actually a good thing.
Yeah, so it feels like there's a sort of paradigm shift in the way that films may be distributed. Yeah. I mean, we've talked about this before, where you famously don't have real television anymore,
and real television,
and that that notion of a time of day when a certain program is so. I mean, I know it's not film, but in TV, it's like you don't have to watch things as they're sort of curated for you. You can watch things whenever you want, things like the advent of Netflix, and you were telling me about Amazon Prime the other day, how they've got all this kind of stuff, and there's just so much going on. It just feels like the market is awash now with all these disparate distribution methods. So I think I'm looking forward to learning more. I'm going to be there.
Good.
Apparently
you'll be there
on hand, sort of fetching the waters and manning the booth. That's what I do. I'm a booth boy. It's all good.
Yeah.
So where can people find out more information, and if there's any film listeners out there?
You can find out more information at ind.ie/direct.
I like it. Good domain.
Mm-hmm.
Very good domain. But anyway, that was my first link.
Cheers. Thank you.
I expect it back in kind at some point.
Obviously.
Yeah. But what have you got for us this week, Kim?
Well, I am going from a very little project to an enormous behemoth of a site, Getty Images.
Getty Images, yes.
And the
rings
fact
a bell.
That they have gone free. Have you read about this?
I have. Yes. I kind of did a double take when I read it. But
it's a huge step, and it's 35 million photographs.
All on one web page.
Yeah,
that's going to take a while to
load. Don't try and embed them all.
There's the thing, right? There's the thing. It's right. Embedding images, yeah?
Yes. So a lot of people thought this was just that they were taking all the watermarks off their images and it was a free-for-all, but that's not the case. It is just like the technology behind, embed a tweet and all that stuff. You just get an iframe tag and you stick that into your page, and there's your image from Getty Images. And obviously there's a credit at the bottom, a link to buy that image, and there's a couple of social links and that kind of thing. So it's not quite a free-for-all, but this article that I'll link to from the show notes on the Verge, Verge, wonderful website by the way, they point out that that this stuff's already out there. I think it's their biz dev person, I've lost his name, but the biz dev person for Getty Images was basically saying that their content's already out there. If you find an image you like on Getty Images, you need to drag that into Google Image Search and you can find someone who's ripped it off. Because fundamentally, he's already bought the image and steal it off their website. So they're saying that, the gate has already been left open. The horse has already bolted, so to speak. So this isn't a case of like this is suddenly a new thing. But they're trying to get more control over where their images appear and the data around those images and who's looking at them and that kind of thing. And so this is their solution to that.
So that's interesting. I guess it is a problem. But why? What are they hoping to gain beyond data? I mean, where's the money? I mean, is it just, do you think this is just going to cater for people who would have, in inverted commas, stolen the imagery before? Or do you think it's actually going to encourage discovery, or when people click back, or what do you think?
I suspect this is about the same argument as, you know, as film or music or any of these things where they say that if you just make the image available to people, they won't steal it. Where the money is a good question, because it's not as if Getty Images is having problems in terms of profit. It says in this article that they increased their profit 100 million from 2007 to 2011. So they're not having the same sort of hemorrhaging effect that the media industry is having generally with piracy. Yeah. So I don't think it was necessarily in terms of money that was their issue. I think they just wanted to sort of gain more control over what happens to their images. And they think by allowing you to use them, it's, you know, I suspect that if they looked at their breakdown for the where they made money, the online blog buying a stock image revenue stream was very, very small.
Mm.
So they thought, if we lose that to a free embed, we get our brand out there more, we get data about who's looking at our images, and possibly someone might see the image and want to buy it for a print campaign. So, you know,
yeah,
I think it's sort of... it's an interesting one, because you start to ask yourself, like, well, will The Guardian start using this for images from the Oscars? You know, because traditionally, I imagine they'd either have to have their own photographers there, or they'd have to buy them from the likes of Getty Images or Reuters or whatever. So, you know, I do wonder if they are going to see a downturn in revenue because of it. But I can't see where the money is, like you say.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because not every business decision like this, I mean, you know that this will have been thought out long and hard, right, by Getty Images. There's a definite reason that they've done this, and they'll definitely have a strategy behind it. It's just not apparent to, our little minds. But I guess, yeah, maybe it's a brand play. Maybe it's a case of, well, it's better for people to embed and, you know, get more of those and get the links back and people seeing great imagery and you know, just making that available. I guess it's like, yeah, if you like, they'll be appearing all over the web, won't they? You know, they're linked back to Getty. So,
and I've just seen here that it's Craig Peters who's the biz dev guy I was talking about.
Right.
And he's saying here that there's an also a play to be had in terms of advertising. So that'll be interesting.
I suppose once they've got control of that embed, who's to say what could turn up in it? Yeah.
Yeah. So once they know what type of site they're looking at, say looking at a movie site or a fashion site or whatever, then they can start to, you know, plant ads in those iframes. So yeah, that could be the bigger play. I mean, they're pushing the data angle in this article.
Yeah, maybe then down the line that you.
But
he does say,
or it's an advertising play.
Well, yeah. So maybe down the track you'll be able to remove the ads from the iframe.
Yes, exactly. Pay to remove the ad. Yeah.
An oldie but a goldie.
It is. It's an interesting one, and I think that ultimately, I think it's the right thing to do in terms of them regaining some control over the situation. Because, you know, fundamentally, right now, I imagine their stuff's being ripped off constantly, and they can't really do much about it. You know, they give the example of what's that website called? History in Pics. So it's a Twitter account called History in Pics, and basically it's full of stuff from Getty Images, but they can't do anything about it because History in Pics has zero revenue.
Right.
You know, so it's just a guy who tweets pictures of historical stuff and talks about them. So, and obviously they've got millions of followers or whatever, but the reality is there's actually no money in it. So even if they went after them, you know, there's no money to be had.
Yeah, I wonder as well whether they, you know, they could extend this feature so that you could embed, you know, galleries and that kind of thing. It wouldn't take much, would it, to sort of, if you were, you know, a news blog, to have like a hero and then sort of four or five swappable images in there as well.
No, exactly. Like, yeah. Especially if it's sort of a breaking news story, because they could encourage newspapers and magazines and stuff to pull that embed and they update it as it happens.
So yeah, I guess there's an issue there about consent of pushing data in to someone else's site. But I mean, you know, it's all solvable problems,
isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting.
It's an interesting one, and I think it's quite a cool move from such a big old school company.
Absolutely. Have you actually seen a site that's got one of the embeds on you? I haven't. Been looking, to be honest.
I don't know if they're actually released yet or not.
Oh, okay.
I see a screenshot here of one, but I don't know if they're actually being used in the wild yet. But they say it was certainly announced a couple of days ago.
This is cool. There's The Verge has got a great site, actually. It's a great site.
Great content as well.
I mean, when was this out? I mean, I've only really sort of started seeing their articles linked up in the last maybe year, 18 months, is it?
Verge, oh, I mean, I've only seen it in the last couple of years, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
Vox Media.
They belong to something. Oh, Vox Media.
It means nothing
to me. They do something else, don't they?
There's some great headlines on the side here, such as Massachusetts race to ban upskirt photos after court says they're legal. That's why I should have gone into law and not gone into the web.
But, yeah, exactly.
But it's all good. Yeah, so we'll link that up on The Verge. Yeah, I could try and read out the URL, but it would make no sense. We'll use that old thing, HTML. Remember that?
Yeah.
We'll inject it with JavaScript. It's all good. cool. So moving on. Right. Okay. I came across... it's not really a plug. It's more a statement of fact. But Elliot and I are working on issue 2 of Digest at the moment.
Not a plug at all.
It's not a plug. It's just a fact. It's, something that happened.
Yeah. Just a historical event.
Just a historical event. Issue 2, Digest, readdigest.com. yeah. And I was doing some research about how other magazine sites are put together.
Yeah.
And came across this one, Uppercase Magazine. And I don't know if you've had a chance to look at it, but I just think this isn't their sales site. Isn't it? It's just their kind of their sort of set. It's not their sales site. They actually use a Shopify store, which is another reason that I obviously like it. But that's by the by.
Oh,
other platforms are available. Is that two to me, one to you?
Well, you won't mention the other platforms.
Other platforms do exist, but shall not be mentioned. But yeah, this site, so uppercasemagazine.com.
Yes.
And I just thought it was the care and attention. So they're 20 issues in, which for an independent magazine is a massive feat, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that is seriously, seriously good going. I think it's quarterly, so it's been going 4 or 5 years, whatever the maths works out at. Mm-hmm. And I just thought the sheer depth of content, and it's just really engaging. I think the site, the way that it's presented and the way that they've got these great little videos of sort of thumbing through the magazine. And
they've even got a video per issue.
Yeah.
That pimps the magazine.
And even the ads and stuff down the side and little U blog and all this kind of stuff. I just think it's a really good example. Something to aspire to if you're selling like a magazine, because it really brings the brand and the ideas and the people behind it to life. It tells that story.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to highlight it because it just feels like, I found myself clicking through all these issues and wanting to buy them all, I just think some of the wording's nice and the style, it's very, very simple sort of, but it really shines through the covers and that kind of stuff. Did you have an opportunity to have a look around?
Yeah, I've been looking through it. Yeah. It's very attractive, isn't it? All of it's very, very beautiful looking. I couldn't really get a grip of what the subject matter was, but I guess that's the point. It's generalist, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's all things that look lovely. And I guess there's some sort of design focus. Is that right?
Yeah, I think it's one of the issues I was sort of watched the video about was everything from, co-working through to food and drink and travel. Just, right. For the creative and curious is a strap line.
Yeah, makes sense.
I just thought it was really nice. I mean, just a really nice way of showing off.
There's a lot happening in the indie publishing space, isn't there, at the moment?
Yeah, it's funny. I've done a, I won't spoil who it is with, but did an interview for Elliot's Eight Faces with someone from the, who's well known in magazine publishing circles.
Magazine land.
And as he says, it's kind of a really great time now for independent publishing, but it's not without its challenges. And one of those is distribution, getting it into the hands of the readers for sure. And the economics of it as well is the other big one.
Yeah.
And I think if you're making a living publishing 4 issues of a magazine a year, that's amazing.
And presumably paying a team and
I believe there's a couple of people involved in Uppercase. So And it shows, you know, the care and attention and the craft here just sort of shines through to me. It's just really well put together.
It's very nice, isn't it?
Very nice. But, yeah, there's, I believe as well, she's the lady behind it, Janina's, I don't know if she's a Kickstarter or whether it funded through through the site even. Let's have a look. Project Goal Tracker. What's this one? Who's it? But she raised $25,000 last year to write a history of the typewriter. the old school typewriter. And if you go to the typewriter link in the left hand side there.
The typewriter.
Yeah. And who knew? Who knew? But looks very interesting.
That's cool.
The typewriter, a graphic history of the beloved machine.
The same kind of care and attention to this as well. You can sort of see there's a video there, and there's, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's another good thing. You know, great use of video, something that I think we probably missed out on, because video, you can put the size of a magazine or the content into context as well and things like that. It's just really well done.
Yeah, yeah. I can't see what she's used actually to fund this. I can see the Project Goal Tracker, but I can't see how she's done it. I guess maybe she just did the old, you know, donate by PayPal type thing.
Yeah, maybe.
Nice.
But yeah, go check it out, uppercasemagazine.com.
Yeah, very cool.
Very cool. Right. Oh, was it a film-related one? Really?
Sorry.
Oh.
It's tech-related.
I know.
You know, we've been very film-heavy, but...
It's the intersection of film and technology.
This is Netflix 2014 European expansion.
I've heard of them.
And this is Variety, and it's a look ahead from a guy who I think is actually a really good writer, Andrew Wallenstein, I think that's how you pronounce his name. He's the editor-in-chief of Digital at Variety.
All right.
And he's done a sort of like, first of all, sort of a deep dive on the video on demand, or over the top, or however you want to describe it, market in Europe, and a sort of analysis of Netflix next move, so to speak, in terms of pushing deeper into the European market, because at the moment they are in the Nordic countries and the UK only.
Okay.
So the next move apparently is Germany, and then Holland, and then France, and then Spain. So they're just going to a huge push in 2014, basically. And it's costing them a lot of money, because this is actually taking them into negative figures in terms of their balance sheet.
Okay.
So that you know, given the amount of what they want to do is they want to add 30 million international subscribers. Between now and 2018, they've already got 31.7 million US subscribers and 9.7 million international subscribers.
So how many in the States?
31.7 million.
Wow. Well, there's some crazy stat about the amount of internet traffic that is Netflix.
30%.
30%, wow, in the States, right?
Yeah. It's pretty crazy.
That's pretty big.
No, sorry, that's worldwide. So worldwide internet usage. It's
30%. Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So it's crazy. And he goes a lot of detail about how all these different streaming providers are starting to do original programming in order to draw you away from other, you know, to make them the desirable things. So things like House of Cards and now From Dusk Till Dawn and all these things that. These original series to ensure that they're exclusive to Netflix or exclusive to Amazon or whatever, you know, whichever platform you use.
So what's the model for Netflix? Do they pay the people who make the films and the production companies a percentage of watches, mm-hmm. or
it's the same as Spotify. Got Shopify on my mind. Same as Spotify. They pay them a percentage based on plays. But the real exciting thing, and there's another article that we can link up about Netflix, is that they've sort of reverse engineered Hollywood. So Hollywood started off producing films and then distributing films, and then ultimately also bought up all the exhibition for films to try and control the whole market, whereas Netflix have kind of gone the opposite route, where they were the exhibition for films and they started distributing, and now they're producing. they've gone at it from the opposite angle.
So do you know the backstory to Netflix? Did it come out of another big company, or was it a startup? Or
I think it was a startup. I don't actually know their history, but I know that they were a mail order company before anything else, I believe. So things like, just like Love Film was here.
Oh, okay. So you got DVDs in the post.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah, and there was a whole concept of queuing. Like they used to be on Love Film, where you'd queue different things you wanted to see, and then you get sent one of them.
Nice, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. But I think that part of the business has all but disappeared. Obviously.
Do you subscribe to Netflix?
I don't anymore. No, I've switched to Amazon Prime.
What was your motivation for that?
Fact that I had Amazon Prime.
Oh, okay. And is there similar? but there's no sort of, set or things that you wanted that was on Prime that wasn't on Netflix, or
not particularly. I did see. I think having had Netflix for about a year, I had watched a lot of what I wanted to watch on Netflix, and there wasn't enough coming on quick enough for me to be that interested. You know, especially as you said earlier, that I haven't got normal television, so to speak. I haven't got programmed television
through choice.
So, yes, it's not as if I live somewhere you can't get television.
For anyone out there wishing to move to Wales, they do have a television.
We do have television
and intermittent 2G coverage.
Yes.
Or is that just your house? You can only stand in certain areas of your house
to get a signal. In my bay window to talk to you. Yes, that's right.
Yeah, that's very odd.
But anyway, yeah. So I think because of that, I'd watched a lot of stuff that I liked on Netflix, and so switching to Amazon's given me more choice.
Again, a bit like the film distribution topic we were discussing earlier, do you think one of these services will... I mean, it feels like there's a lot going on in this space. And currently, I think we, for mainly to do with kids' programs, we have a couple of subscriptions, because there's Max and Ruby on Netflix, but it's not on something else. And there's something else on what was Love Film, but it's not on something else. And Do you think they'll converge or get bought out, or will Amazon end up buying everyone? What do you
I think undoubtedly, well, I don't think they'll end up buying Netflix, but I think undoubtedly some of the smaller operators will get bought up. But I think that in the sort of, I mean, they talk about this in this article, saying that, you know, a lot of the European providers are excited about this because Netflix have got so much clout that it's going to bring far more awareness to these type of services in Europe.
Yeah. So it could help the competitors in a way.
That's what they're saying. Yeah. So far from it being a problem for them, it could actually grow their market.
Oh, that's interesting.
So I think you're going to see an explosion of far more. You know, I think it's got at its tipping point, if you see what I mean now, and we're getting much more mass market adoption, especially with all these different boxes. You know, the Steam box is coming out in, you know, a matter of weeks probably, and that's going to bring with it a whole new store full of goodies that will be exciting. But I think that probably for a long time we'll just see people either having multiple subscriptions or just being brand loyal to someone like Netflix.
Yeah,
I don't think we're going to see people starting to monopolize the market quite yet.
I've just seen a link that you'll probably want to check out. Actually, Vimeo pledges $10 million to fund indie film projects on its internet VOD platform.
Oh yeah, I've seen that. Yeah.
Old news, Keir. Old news. Yeah. But maybe discuss that next time. But yeah, it's again, it feels like there's a lot of track left in this, and in terms of. I'm sure we'll see a couple of new services this year. And from a slow beginning, I remember sort of people talking about Netflix and Hulu and all those kind of things in the States. And it took quite a while to come here, but it feels like we're kind of on a trajectory sort of.
Yeah.
That we'll see a few more services coming online, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I'm sure as well that you will let us know about those.
Obviously, yeah. And I'll obviously try and keep this on track.
On our technical web-focused podcast. Yeah.
But luckily you're going to bring it right back down.
I am.
With some coding guidelines.
you have to throw in one, at least one, don't you? But actually, so this is by at MDO on the Twits, Mark. Coding guidelines.
Nice.
Standards for developing flexible, durable, hard to say, strangely, and sustainable HTML and CSS. And the only reason I link this up is because I think I mean, it's hard to disagree with everything in here, right? I mean, there's a few of these around, but I just thought, what's your take on it? Where do you think these come in useful? Because HTML, it's not, and CSS, it's one of those things that you do have a little bit of control over. There's no, you know, it's not like Python where if you don't have the indents, it's not going to run. You can literally lay it out however you want within reason, right?
Yeah.
And everyone has their own style, and, you know, you work with different developers, and you can kind of work out who's, after a while, you can work out who's written what. Same with that, I guess, server-side code to a certain degree.
Yes, definitely.
And I think these are great for sort of best practices and that, but how useful do you think they are in the real world? I mean, you've worked in more, you know, big companies. Did you have style guidelines? I mean...
Yeah, we did, yeah. I think that, and I think actually when your team grows over a certain size, this becomes very important. And I'm sure a lot of people would disagree with me. I know one man... Mr. John Matthews, your friend of mine,
Johnham,
would be I would think it's fair to say he foams at the mouth about these kind of things because he's such a stickler for coding guidelines, because it really does matter when you start working in a bigger team.
Yeah.
I think it's all very well if you're in isolation and you're producing a small site for yourself to code however you want, but it's good practice to start picking up these kind of things. And I'm not entirely, you know, I'm not convinced that there is, you know, one true method of doing this, but I think that if you, what you should do is if you're in a team, you should pick one of these sets and stick to it. And that's you know, we picked the Zen coding standards for Zend coding standards, sorry, for PHP when we were working in a certain unnamed company together, John and I. But that, you know, that's what we used, and we all stuck to it in the team, and it made things a lot nicer and a lot more comfortable to have to pick up someone else's code.
Yeah, I mean, I think as the front end grows to be more complicated, and, you know, the developments with things like SAS and sort of JavaScript and that kind of stuff, it makes an awful lot of sense, I guess. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, what Mark's done here is great, and I'm like looking through it and I think, yeah, God, this is great. I mean, I tend to code stuff for myself more than anyone else these days, so I'm not sure, you know, there's a temptation to just go with what you know, but I think having things like declaration order is something I've always done. I remember reading an article, I think who was it by? I got years and years and years ago, back in the dark ages, like 2003, mm-hmm. Probably by someone like Dan Cederhope. No, it might have been actually Doug Bowman, who's now at Twitter. Mm-hmm. How he laid out his CSS and the order that he did it, and he always, I can't remember the bits in between, but he always kind of started with the background and ended with the color, if it was for text and stuff. And
sure.
And I just always remember I've kind of always stuck to a certain order that I tend to do the sort of, you know, start with the background, margin, padding, that kind of stuff, then do the box elements, then do type, and then do kind of other stuff, and then always finish on color.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting because that's something that I've never done. You know, I've never ordered my CSS in that way, and but much of the other stuff I have done. So it's sort of, it shows that sometimes you pick up these habits, just you pick up sort of standards just by working on your own in isolation anyway. But I think these things really come into their own when there's more than one of you on the project.
Yeah, I think there's a section here called practicality over purity. You know, strive to maintain HTML standards and semantics, but not at the expense of practicality. Use the least amount of markup with the fewest intricacies whenever possible.
Yeah.
And I like that. You know, it's a nod to that nothing's perfect and things are going to get messy. But this is so, you know, there's so much in here. And I think maybe if I was starting up an agency or company or something like that, I would... Yeah, this is something I definitely
point to.
It's interesting that you said about the Zend with the D, Zend coding standards. Mm-hmm. There's a few. I think PHP's got. There's a few of those. Is there one called PRS something or PSR? I know that they use in the Laravel. They recommend that you use that kind of structure. And I think
PSR standards. Yeah,
PSR standards. And you know, on the server side, I think there's a lot of that, but it's really nice to see, you know, a lot of these sort of, I mean, it's not a style guide as such, is it? It's more of a, like, you know, coding standards.
Coding standards, yeah, it's plain and simple, yeah. It's a coding standards document.
And it's really nicely put together, and, you know, it covers everything from HTML, JavaScript, CSS.
Indents.
Indents, all that kind of stuff. So, yeah. If you're starting out or, you know, you just want to, you know, you're going to be working in a team, I think this will be a great place to start.
Yeah, I agree. Especially if you're doing lots of front end stuff, there's more and more people who have, and even just agencies that are focused on front end. And I think that, you know, if you're doing that kind of thing, this is one of the first front end standards documents I've seen.
Yeah, no, it's really nice. Mark Otto is the guy behind it. He's the creator of Bootstrap.
He's from GitHub, right?
He is now at GitHub, was at Twitter. Before that, I think he was at Zurb. He's done an awful lot. Interesting guy.
Nice.
But yeah, you can find him on the Twitter at
At
MDO.
MDO,
But
yeah.
we'll put a link to his style guide in the show notes because I think it's worth a read. Yeah, actually, you always end up learning something when you look at these as well. I think
Yeah.
it's not just a case of following the lead. It's oh, that's quite interesting. Oh, okay. You know, there's a lot in there, so definitely worth a check out. And actually, you're going to round out with a
With a
web
proper tech
proper
story.
tech story.
This is the news that GitHub have released their hackable text editor, Atom.
Yes. I understand as well that you had some invites that you just
excuse me.
willy-nilly gave away to
Well, I
people.
felt I gave them to developers.
Right. Okay.
We have covered this in great detail. Yes, I didn't send you an invite. I apologize for that. I was limited to three, and
And I
there
refer
were
you
other
back to the
developers.
Dribbble invite gate
More
from 3 years ago.
than well, more than that,
Need we say more? We'll
okay.
take this
I did sort you
offline
out
and
with an invite.
discuss, you know.
Is that fair to say?
Say again.
I did sort you out with an invite. That's
No,
fair to
you
say.
said Neil's got an invite, talk to him.
Yeah, and then I said to Neil on Skype, send Kieran an invite.
Well, I also asked Neil, so
Did you?
you had to nudge it. Honestly, the pair of you, nightmare. And it's not like even Neil likes it. He's gone back
Not
to
like it.
Sublime. No, I don't think he likes it.
Well, I like it.
Why do you like it?
I never really, this is, we've talked about this before, so I'm not going to labour the point. I never really connected with Sublime.
Why?
For whatever reason, I don't know. I just it just wasn't for me. And I know that sounds like not very analytical, but I struggled to move from TextMate to Sublime. And I think and I ended up using Sublime, but I just it just it's never really felt at home with it. Whereas Atom, I first of all, I really like sort of that the hackability of the config and the init scripts and the snippets and all that stuff. I really like that. I'm sure you could do similar things with Sublime. I just never looked into it. It never came as naturally as Atom. So for those that don't know, Atom is written in Node.js, and there's a whole range of different customizations and hackable stuff you can do to it. And really, I haven't explored that to a great extent. I've converted the Liquid package from Mixture to Atom so that I could
You've
get
done what?
syntax
Really?
highlighting. Yeah, I
Hope you've contributed that back to the community, Kieran.
have contributed. I think it's available on the Atom package list right now.
So hip. So hip.
And but yeah, there's some like there's really nice stuff. Just even just the, having open style sheets so that you can change the style of your text of your editor with CSS, basically.
Yeah, I like that. That's nice.
Yeah, and the snippets are really nice as well. So
What do they do explicitly?
it means that you can basically write a word, hit tab, and it will just inject anything you put into the snippet. So for example, if I have a snippet called HTML. I type HTML, I press tab, and it just spits into the page a skeleton HTML document that I've written.
Okay.
So if I'm writing a new HTML document, I just have to type HTML tab, and it'll give me the doc type, HTML tag, head, title, all that stuff just drops straight in from my snippets. And you can define those just in a text file.
Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah,
Yeah.
it's just really useful stuff, you know.
I had a play,
Yeah.
and I want to, you know, give it more time because it does look really interesting. Obviously, I think the integration with Git and,
Yeah,
you
there's
know,
a whole
your
bunch of
Git.
Git information, I should say that, yeah.
Yeah, which I
So.
think is obviously, you know, to have that built in is a big win. Mm-hmm. Visually, very like Sublime. The themes are very, yeah, very similar. Yeah. There's a few things that sort of muscle memory that I do with Sublime that I tried out and ended up kind of deleting lines instead of highlighting them and stuff. But
oh, right, yeah.
But it did seem to have quite a few of similar packages. So if you're used to Emmet and things like that, that's mm-hmm. in there. There are a few other bits and bobs. What do you think, you know, Git's motivation for doing this is? I mean, it's obviously...
GitHub,
sorry.
What's their motivation for doing it? I think it might be a little bit of a scratch your own itch thing.
Yeah.
I think that's definitely part of it. I think there's also... my take on what GitHub is doing is that they're trying to get more and more, I don't want to say control, but they want to be servicing developers' needs in more and more ways. You know, and I was quite surprised when I saw like desktop clients cropping up for GitHub a while ago, produced by them. And I sort of, at that point, I started to think to myself, maybe they're trying to sort of, you know, work their way into more parts of your workflow. Than just Git, so I think this might be the first sort of play for them in that area. I could definitely see them producing something like CodeKit or Mixture, that kind of thing as well, or building that into Atom. I think that just starts to make sense. You know, there's also a live preview mode in Atom, which I thought was a first sort of taste of that kind of thing. So you can do live preview of, I believe, Markdown at the moment. That's the only one that's been released on the store. Package list. But so almost like Ghost, where you type in Markdown or whatever, and then you see that in the other pane.
Yeah.
Rendered. I think they're going to be doing the same thing for HTML and Liquid and all, you know, all sorts of other stuff. So I think that's potentially very exciting as well.
Yeah, also, I mean, it is very well crafted, and it, you know, it looks really, really nice. And
yeah, when I first ran it, it was really fast, but I'm seeing some slowdown. I don't know whether that's my machine or whether the projects I'm opening in it have a lot of files or what it is. But I've seen it takes a little, it's got a little slight hang when I open a project.
Okay.
I don't know whether that's something I wasn't used to with Sublime. Sublime was so fast.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big fan of Sublime. I've been using it for a few years now, and you kind of just get used to it. I mean, text editors, you know, they're not complicated, but they become that once you start having all these different useful utility things. And I do really like Sublime, and I think it, again, at the end of the day, whatever you like to get the job done. I mean, there are things out there that you can employ that might help you in the long term, but sometimes you just, you know, familiarity, and you need to, you know, check yourself and sometimes go back and give other things a try. But it looks really good. It's not available to everyone. How do you get it? You have to sign up and then they send you an invite, is it? Or
yeah, that's right. So at the moment there's a waiting list, or if you happen to know someone who's already got Atom access, then everyone gets 3 invites by the looks of things. I was recently just sent an invite randomly. I hadn't signed up for an invite or anything like that, and I got sent one randomly, so I don't know whether they're starting to send them out just to GitHub users.
Oh, that would make sense. I mean, they've got a big community there, I'm sure.
Exactly. So I'm thinking maybe that's where they're going, or maybe they're sending them out to paid GitHub members first or something like that. But whatever it is, there seems to be something going on that I didn't sign up for. So
didn't sign up for indiscriminate sending of just free software. It's outrageous.
Yeah, I tried to give that invite out, didn't work. So
you tried to give that one out, did you?
Yeah,
tried to a deserving cause.
Yeah, but it didn't work, you know. So because obviously they don't have my email address. So
it's not like you didn't have my email address.
No, this was after you'd been given an invite by Neil.
I don't know what to say. But anyways,
you're not bitter at all.
No,
that was a grudge.
No, I mean, you know me. Never hold a grudge.
Never know you to hold a grudge, no.
Never knowingly hold a grudge.
No.
Other people know, but I don't. It's just the way it goes.
It's the way it is.
Right.
Yeah.
Wrapping up for this week, episode 22.
This is a corker.
So apparently, some flying skateboard is now available.
We're living in the future, Keir.
Yeah, it's like we've gone back to the future.
It is almost like we have gone back to the future at 88 miles an hour.
Yes.
This obviously quite close to my heart.
Yeah.
For those who know me, I ran a company called 80 Miles Per Hour, which was a reference to Back to the Future. And this is the story that HoverTech, HUVRTech.com.
If you said that in a Somerset accent, it'd be HooverTech.
HoverTech.
Yeah, I like that.
Are reporting to be in possession of a real-life hoverboard, which is, of course, complete tosh.
Really?
But it's quite interesting.
How is it? How do you know this?
Well, because first of all, if you watch the video, there's a video, for everyone who hasn't seen it yet, there's a video on hovertech.com of a whole different bunch of celebs, including Christopher Lloyd driving a DeLorean, testing out the hoverboards. And if you look at it, I mean, it's been done quite well, admittedly not as well as the film was done in 1985, but actually 1987 at that point. Anyway, not as good as the film, but there has been done quite well considering the production values involved. But you can clearly see that the physics aren't right. You know, the way they're standing on the board, the way the board's moving, the way they move the board away from the ground, but yet it still hovers. That kind of stuff is all wrong. And also, I can't believe that if this technology was real, that there would be that the first thing we'd have known about this is a YouTube video. of a whole bunch of celebrities playing on them.
I don't know. The cynic in you, Kieran, it's upsetting.
Well, no, but what I'm more interested in, a positive note, is what's this advertising? What is this a promotion for? According to the website, it's currently March 2014. We know that. And something is happening. Destination time is December 2014. So something is apparently brewing. What? I don't know. And there's lots of really famous people involved with this. So Moby's on the video, but very random, but famous people. Tony Hawk.
Well, legend.
Legend in our time.
Has he done like a 1280 or something on it? Or
No, he's the first person to step on the board in the video. And we've also got a very odd quote from Mark Cuban, of all people, venture capitalist, saying this is the best thing he's ever invested in. So there's a whole bunch of celebrities involved. As I said, Christopher Lloyd's involved. So clearly this is some kind of marketing campaign for something big. But what? I don't know. Now, I do know that Nike are due to release their Power Laces sneaker.
Don't tell me. December 2014?
Well, I don't know when exactly, but they said it was coming in the next 12 months, last time I read. Ah. So it could be related to that. A lot of people are speculating that it's related to a new Back to the Future film, which has been talked about for a long time. I had read that Christopher Lloyd said that he wouldn't do it, and Michael J. Fox wouldn't do it, and Michael J. Fox said he wouldn't do it. So I don't know what the truth is, but it certainly isn't hoverboards.
Well, you're up to now.
What did you feel, Keir, when you watched the video? Did you think this is the future?
I just want to believe. I think it's great.
You just want to believe that they're really hovering, yeah?
Absolutely. I mean, I've got my colour. I think I'd go for maybe the green and blue.
Would you?
Yeah, or maybe the blue and red.
There's also a fake selection of colours available on the website.
Well, no, they're real colours. I've seen those before. Well, those colours do exist.
They do exist.
Blue is a colour.
They're not available as hoverboards, we hasten to add. But to be fair, they are claiming they are at this point. I think I'd have to go for the pink one, because obviously it's the one from the film.
It's you all over.
Yeah. This brings us round to our fixie conversation again.
What was that again?
Fixies? Well, when we were talking about which fixie we'd buy in the first episode.
Zombie Stomper.
Yeah, the Zombie Stomper, yeah.
My opinion hasn't changed.
Right, fair enough, yeah.
So much so that I bought it.
Have you really?
Have you not seen it?
No.
No.
Yeah, so I don't know what you think, but I'm definitely in the fake camp.
Back to the Future 4.
You think it's Back to the Future 4, do you?
A prequel. Surely they're too old to be in it now and make them look young again. There's practicalities about having the same actors.
What would it consist of, though? Because that would be pre the time machine's creation, pre the DeLorean's creation. So what would, you know, what would a prequel consist of? Unless, of course, the DeLorean comes into it by coming back into a period.
There you go. That's it. That's the one.
Of course, the DeLorean was destroyed at the end of the third film.
See, I never really got to the end of part three.
You what?
I know.
Sorry.
What?
Have we been talking false pretenses all this time? You haven't seen the end of Back to the Future 3?
No. It's all kind of like cowboys. I'm never really interested in westerns.
Right.
Okay. Two, quite like two. Two was good. Three.
I thought you liked Django.
What?
Django Unchained. It's a western.
No, I've not seen that. No, western.
No.
No.
So you got a policy? You're anti-western?
No, not anti-western.
I hate to say it, but westerns are in at the moment, Keir.
Really?
Yeah. Big time.
It's like, oh dear. Fashion. So no JS, fixies, westerns.
Yeah. And hoverboards, apparently.
Hoverboards. Oh, got a lot to do.
Yeah, you have.
Right, on that bombshell.
On that bombshell.
I better go off and...
You still haven't told me whether you think it's fake or not.
Fake.
Fake, good. So the official line of the Back to Front show is that hovertech.com is fake. And if it's real, come Christmas and we're buying each other hoverboards.
Have you done a whois on the domain?
Yes, whois privacy, mate.
No, they've thought of everything.
They have.
Where's it resolved to?
You think I didn't whois the domain?
Well.
Who do you think I am?
Whois Spring Studio? Are they real? That's the site creators.
Yeah, they are real, I think.
Oh, they've got kind of like, what's that?
Bit of digital detective work live here.
American Express, Hovertech. Walmart. No, they're real.
Use this title if it's in the page. YAML formatter.
I don't know. Oh, it's got a nice studio, Spring Studio.
Mm.
I like that. Nice bit of usage of green.
Loverly.
Right, anyways, whilst we get our head around the truth about hoverboards,
truth
we shall sign off.
Yes.
Anyways, that was episode 22. Can you believe it?
No.
I can't.
Again, we made it.
A half hour has descended into almost an hour.
Yeah.
We were only doing links to shorten the show.
We talked for ages about, what's it?
What?
Getty Images.
It's true. Link again.
Yeah, sorry about that.
But, thanks again to the Webbiz for supporting this week's show. Don't forget to check them out at theweb.is. Mm-hmm. IS.
That's your Somerset accent coming
out. Or the Webbiz. Where's IS? Where's that from? Come on. You know what
I don't know.
We'll find out for the next show. But yes.
Iceland.
Is it? Really? Iceland.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's not taking place in Iceland. It's in Cardiff.
It's definitely in Cardiff. Cardiff. Just like Indie Direct is definitely in London.
Definitely in London. 30th to the 31st of October.
Yes.
Cool. Thanks for joining me, Kieran. And we shall be back with episode 23. There is rumour of a new theme song.
It won't happen.
No?
No.
I'm thinking some 8-bit Paul McCartney or Wings.
No. We discussed this, off air.
Come on, so Jet. It's a classic.
It's not happening.
Really?
No.
Live and Let Die?
No.
No? Band on the Run?
No.
Incidentally, I'm going to put it in the show notes, the whole of Band on the Run as an 8-bit extravaganza is available on YouTube.
Which is probably banned as torture by the European community.
I'm a bit upset that they call it Paul McCartney and then in bracket and Wings. It was Wings. Greatest band of the 70s. Biggest selling, weren't they?
Though latterly, it wasn't that what was on the album covers.
Was it?
I think so. Or maybe it was before. I think it was at the beginning that was what was on the album covers, and then it turned into just Wings.
I think Jet also, Alan Partridge is one of his favourite songs.
Yeah.
Which is a big endorsement.
Ben is. Yes.
Right. On that, I shall bid you farewell. I'll speak to you soon.
Cheers.